This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. In light of the shootings yesterday at Northern Illinois University, we're going to do a special program this afternoon in this portion of the program, looking at the incident and others like it. We'll ask how and why such deadly violence erupts in our schools. We'll also bring you more information on yesterday's shootings in DeKalb as that information becomes available. Since the late 1990s, the U.S. has seen several shooting sprees at schools. In West Paducah, Kentucky, in the late 90s, a high school freshman shot into a prayer circle before classes were to begin at Heath High School. Three students were killed.
More recently, a gunman killed 32 people and wounded 15 others at Virginia Tech University. The gunman then killed himself. That shooting on April 16th of last year was the deadliest campus shooting in U.S. history.
And David Inge, the host of Focus 580, is my co-host this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Also joining me in the studio, Tom Rogers. He has a recap of what happened yesterday, Tom.
Well, it's hard to believe that it's not yet been 24 hours since this all happened, and the real extent of the tragedy really didn't make itself known until we found out that there were deaths inside that classroom at Cole Hall on the NIU campus. The first word came in the evening, a few hours after the incident had happened. Flags and death beyond the death of the gunman who apparently had turned the gun on himself at Cole Hall. Today, the people are in mourning, obviously. Flags are at half staff across the state of Illinois. The governor's office requested that. And on the floor of the Illinois House in Springfield this morning, Representative Mike Fortner of West Chicago led the chamber in a moment of silence. Fortner, in fact, is a physics professor.
I've been an employee at NIU for the last 20 years, and so this hits me particularly hard. I've walked many, many times past Cole Hall, though I've not actually taught in that particular classroom. I'm very familiar with the arrangement there. I can imagine the fear and the horror if I were giving that lecture and someone broke in with that kind of death and destruction in mind.
Right now, the investigation as it stands, as far as what police have said so far, was that Stephen Kazmierczyk may have stopped taking his medication and had, on the day of the shootings yesterday, had carried a shotgun to campus inside a guitar case, keeping it hidden. The police chief on the NIU campus is Donald Grady. He says Kazmierczyk was taking some kind of medication, but he hasn't released any specifics about what or anything revolving that. Grady says Kazmierczyk was, by all accounts, an outstanding student at NIU, and authorities were still trying to find out why he would kill. From NIU, he enrolled in the University of Illinois School of Social Work last year. His advisor on campus here in Champaign-Urbana was Associate Professor Jan Carter Black, and she says there was no sign in her dealings with Kazmierczyk that something would go wrong.
He was considerate in just those kinds of ways. When he contacted me, for example, to see if we could arrange a time to meet, he was very conscious of my schedule and very willing to adjust his schedule in order to meet mine. He was a very personable young man.
She also called Kazmierczyk personable and respectful of others, and focused his studies on the prison system as his focus in the School of Social Work at the U of I and at Northern Illinois University. NIU's campus is closed again today, and there is no announcement as to when classes would resume there. And, of course, students there are being offered counseling. There are also counseling services that have been available at the U of I for people who may want to seek counseling in some way. You can probably find more information on those counseling services at the main website at www.illinois.edu. And that's where the investigation is right now. And obviously, since it's still a fluid situation and the investigation goes on, more people are being questioned, more facts are being found out. Will certainly not be the end of this for some time.
Okay. And if anything develops over the next hour, you'll bring us up today. Come in.
We'll discuss that as well. And we're also keeping tabs with Champaign police. They've been helping the police in DeKalb with some background. He was a resident of Champaign and lived on the west side of Champaign in an apartment. And they were helping in the investigation there, looking through the apartment, talking to acquaintances and friends. And they'll continue to be involved as well.
Okay, very good. AM 580 News Director Tom Rogers. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. David Inge, the host of Focus 580, is with us this afternoon as well to help us sort through what has happened and where we are. And, you know, help us come to, you know, some understanding of what happened and why did it happen. Also this afternoon, a professor of sociology from Princeton University joins us. Her name is Catherine Newman. She served as one of the authors of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. Published in 2004, that book grew out of the desire of Congress to understand what had happened in West Paducah, Kentucky in 1997, in Jonesboro, Arkansas, and Springfield, Oregon in 1998, and in Littleton, Colorado in 1999. Professor Newman, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
I'm pleased to be with you, Celeste.
And listeners, we invite your thoughts, your questions. You can join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And also this afternoon, you may participate by email. The email address, WILLAMFM@UIUC.edu. Professor Newman, first of all, we're interested in your thoughts as what you heard as Tom Rogers, our news director, outlined the story as we know it at this moment.
Well, I was very struck by some of the similarities to the cases that I studied for the book Rampage. You know, the shooter in Jonesboro, Arkansas, was described as the perfect student, as the most polite person, the kid who would always open up the doors for the lady teachers in the morning, yes, ma'am, no, sir. About 2 months before he gunned down a bunch of fellow middle school students, his mother received a completely unsolicited note from a teacher who said, "You must be so proud of Mitchell. He's just the most wonderful, polite boy." That was just 2 months before this fatal shooting. And what struck me was there were several Mitchell Johnsons, just as I think we're going to discover there were several Stephen Kazmierczyks. There was the Mitchell Johnson that teachers knew, who was invariably polite, who was a model child. There was the Mitchell Johnson that his peers knew, who was an angry boy with a hair-trigger temper. And these two Mitchell Johnsons were very segregated. That is to say, they didn't appear in the same space. And as a result, everyone had a slightly different view of who this person was. And I think we may find out in time that a sort of Jekyll and Hyde-like character may have been lurking in Stephen Kazmierczyk, which wouldn't have been evident to his advisor, because she saw one side of him, but others may have seen something different. I'm also very struck by the desire of most shooters, and I suspect in this case as well, not only to commit suicide, but to take other people with him. That is, to try and reverse his image, this his last act on earth, from something he felt undesirable to something notorious, dangerous, and forever seared in our imaginations in a very unpleasant way. I mean, it will take time before we know the true depths of what happened in this instance at NIU, but I'm struck by some of the similarities that I observed, you know, compared to the high school shootings I spent several years studying.
When things like this happen, inevitably this question is asked of people who knew the individual who was the suspect, who were close to them. The question is, did you detect any signs that something like this might be imminent? And I'm struck by your suggestion that, in fact, you could know someone like this and be close to them and not have seen any indication.
Well, you could not have seen an indication. That is, some people wouldn't have. But typically, for the high school shooters anyway, and we need to go back to the drawing board and find out if this is true in this string of incidents occurring on the nation's college campuses, but typically for the high school shooters, because their intention really is to change the way other people see them, to recast their public image into something notorious and dangerous, they do let off a string of warning signs. They tell people what they're going to do, not in so many words. It's often difficult to interpret what they're telling them, but they let off warning signs. The shooters that we studied would say things to their peers like, we'll see who lives or dies on Monday, or I'm going to be running from the cops for a few weeks so you won't see me. They would say things of this kind, but the peers in their midst didn't really know how to interpret what this meant, especially not before there was a kind of common script, if you will, for a school shooting. When the first cases of this kind began to crop up, nobody could put these threats together and come out with a picture that made much sense. Once we knew such a thing could happen, those warnings took on greater meaning at the time they were uttered. Now, I don't know, we won't know for a while, whether or not this shooter let off any warning signs. But we do know in the cases of the other shooters that they do that because they're trying to attract attention. If all they were trying to do was disappear into a suicidal rage, they wouldn't bother, but they usually have another motive in mind. Now, whether these things apply in this particular case, we will have to find out. In the initial reporting, one can never be completely sure.
Yeah. One of the things that seems to be a common denominator in all these events is that the shooters plan. They don't snap.
Exactly.
How long are they planning?
Sometimes months in advance. In some of the cases I looked at, we had evidence going back 9 months before the shooting that something was being planned. How concrete the plans are varies from one shooter to another. But clearly in this case, this was not somebody who snapped in an hour. He had gone out and purchased these guns, I believe it was about a week before this event. So there was clearly some degree of planning. He knew this place. He knew this building. He didn't pick that at random. So one imagines that he was giving this some thought for a while, but for how long exactly, I don't know. But we do know that these kinds of rampage shootings involving anonymous victims that are not known to the shooter never happen as a consequence of just snapping without warning.
Is it the case that, I think in this particular case, the information we have so far is that there was no relationship between the gunman and the people who he shot. He didn't seem to know them at all. Which is more common, or can you say that it's more common that a person would deliberately target individuals that he knew, or that the people that he would hurt, kill, would be total strangers?
There are really several different kinds of events that look on the surface like they're part of the same family. One is the kind of targeted shooting of a known antagonist. And I would say that's a completely different kind of shooting. Even if it happens on a college campus or a high school, it is really categorically quite different because it involves a pre-existing dispute that spills out into the college or high school context. This kind of event, a rampage shooting of this kind, is really quite different. The fact that the victims are randomly chosen, not known to the shooter, means the shooter is trying to attack the institution, not the individuals. In the shootings that I studied, the shooters didn't even know who they'd killed until after they were arrested, and then the identities were revealed to them because they weren't shooting at particular individuals. These are very different kinds of events. In terms of how common they are, you know, sadly, I think the targeted shooting is probably more common, not on a college campus per se, but in the world in general. Shootings tend to happen between known protagonists, but those kinds of events are really not the same type of social situation is what we're looking at here. And I think the very randomness of the event makes it much more frightening to all of us because, you know, two people who are involved in an antagonism, they may well expect that something terrible could happen between them. But complete strangers in an anonymous setting of this kind, no one ever expects that. And that very randomness is part of what really strikes fear into all of us.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and my name is Celeste Quinn, and David Inge is with me this afternoon. We're co-hosting the Afternoon Magazine, this portion of it today, talking about the shootings that occurred yesterday at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb. Our guest in this hour, Catherine Newman. She's a professor of sociology at Princeton University. She served as one of the authors of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. Listeners, if you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. Listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Yes, I'm a psychologist with the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and I really appreciate you having this topic. I wonder if she could speak to the predictive value of of cruelty toward animals, especially in juveniles, and whether that she's found that to be a precedent of later violence?
That's an excellent question, and the answer is yes, I did, in one particular case, very definitely. And I think that listeners should be aware that kids who are engaging in egregious cruelty to animals are troubled and need help. In one of the cases that we studied, there was clearly evidence of abuse of animals that was not picked up or reported within the community. It was known by peers, but nothing was done about it. And I think almost anyone with the kind of training that your caller has will recognize that that is a real warning sign that should be taken very seriously.
Thank you. And unfortunately, it's not sometimes by even parents in the school system.
Yeah, as it was not in that particular instance.
Right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your call. Let's go on to someone else. This is a caller in Champaign, and the caller here is on line number two. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
My appreciation for the topic. My question is, has anybody ever drawn any connection between this kind of activity and suicide bombing that has become common fare halfway around the world?
That's an interesting question as well. I did speak with some people in the state of New Jersey, law enforcement people, who are concerned about that form of terrorism, and they drew a connection. I have to admit that having not studied suicide bombing, I couldn't really hazard much of an informed answer to you. I would say that the kinds of people who engage in this level of violence do feel deeply alienated and can be attempting to connect with social groups through acts of violence. I can't say that that's necessarily true in this instance, but I can say with respect to the school shooters I've studied before, they often do what they're doing in order to impress or ingratiate themselves with the last group of people they hope will take them in socially. And they think that if they engage in a notorious act, that it will impress people enough and define them as cool in a way that we'll finally get them socially accepted. I could imagine someone arguing that there is a kind of family resemblance, if you will, between that and the motives of a suicide bomber who is also developing a devotion to a social group that will be expressed as a commitment to violence. But it would not be true in every instance, even if it was true occasionally, and it requires a lot more study rather than the kind of speculation that is all I can really give you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we go to a listener in Eureka, Illinois, line four. Hi.
Am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Yeah. I guess it's a thought, and I don't mean it to be a fatalistic one, but it just seems to me, as your guest was remarking about the horror of the randomness of it, that these types of incidents are very, very unpreventable in that we have certain numbers of people in our society who have the potential to do this, and when they do it and how they do it and where they do it is almost totally unpredictable. Your response from your guest, please.
I can't completely agree with this point, though. I could easily see why listeners might feel that way this week, because we've had a number of these incidents just in the last few days. I do believe some of them are preventable. They will never be 100% preventable, but because school shooters typically, though maybe not in this instance, but typically do let off warning signs, if we were better at reading those warning signs and were more responsive to them, it is possible in some instances that we would be able to stop some of these events in their tracks. Indeed, we have a whole long list of what I call near-miss cases where exactly that happened, where a kid was letting off warning signs. His peers finally understood what was being communicated, went to the police, and the police raid the house and find an arsenal and stop a random shooting in its tracks. So it can certainly be done, but by saying that, I don't mean to imply it could always be done or that we should blame institutions or individuals if we fail to stop such a shooting, because no kind of prevention is ever going to be 100% effective, and sometimes we won't see the warning signs and it wouldn't have been possible for anyone to do so. But I wouldn't go as far as to say there's nothing we can do about this and that they are completely unpreventable, because in fact we have seen prevented cases. In the aftermath of cases like this one, typically we actually see a rise in the number of attempted cases because there is a kind of copycat-like mentality that can grip unstable people. But we also see a rise in reporting behavior, and that's a stop to these cases in their tracks. So without raising false hopes that we could ever be 100% effective, I also wouldn't want people to conclude there's nothing to be done here.
All right. Again, I want to thank the last caller and continue to talk with someone next in Champaign and on line number one. Hello? Yes, there we go. Hello.
Yeah, I'm here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please go ahead.
I have a question about the relationship of school shootings to psychiatric drug use. I've heard that 9 out of 10 shooters have been already on these psychiatric medications, and wondered if you've been successful in determining if there's a link, or even if you had that data due to medical privacy laws.
This is a very controversial point. It's been raised on a number of occasions. I have to say that it's not 100% for sure. Most school shooters, at least at the high school level, which is where we have more data, to be perfectly honest, we do not know a lot about college school shootings. They're not as frequent, blessedly. But in the high school instances, the majority of rampage shooters have never been diagnosed with a psychiatric disorder, are not under treatment, have never been classified in a way that would cause them to be on psychiatric medications. This does not mean that there aren't some people who are on psychiatric medications, which appears to have been true in this person's case today.
I was in VTech as well, but they wouldn't say what it was that he was on.
As I say, you know, I would never claim it never happens that way, but what is more striking to me, and in some ways even more disturbing, is that most school shooters actually are not under any kind of psychiatric care at all and have never been diagnosed. Now, one of the reasons that that's often the case is that in the high school context, they are often very young. That is to say, they're so young that they don't quite fit the profile of an extreme psychiatric disturbance that might become evident if they got old enough, if they get that far. I mean, the case we're talking about at NIU involves someone who's 27. The case at Virginia Tech involves someone who was 24. When you look at the shooters that we studied closely who were 14 years old, 11 years old, they are also, unfortunately, afflicted by psychiatric disorders, but they're at the very early stages, and they tend to be harder to diagnose, harder to treat, and then, generally speaking, they weren't. So no psychiatric medications were involved in those cases, but that's not to say they couldn't be.
In the Columbine case, they were.
Pardon me?
In the Columbine case, they were.
Yeah, I didn't say that it never is the case. I'm just saying that, actually, I went through the data on every single school shooting that occurred between the early 1970s and the late, about the year 2000.
Did you actually
In the majority
have the data?
Of the cases, this was not true. However, that doesn't mean that there wasn't a minority of cases where it was.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering if you were able to get the data, because sometimes medical privacy is cited so that you can't even get that data.
Well, we were reasonably good at getting the data, but I have to admit, especially when people have committed suicide as a consequence of all of this, it can be very difficult to backtrack through their lives. So one does have to take this with a certain degree of caution.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, sociologist Catherine Newman. She's a professor of sociology at Princeton University. She served as one of the authors of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings, that book published in 2004. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. David Inch, the host of Focus 580, is helping me out this afternoon. He's my co-host, and we are taking your calls at 333-9455 and toll-free at 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in
Champaign. How about
Champaign,
that?
Line 2. Okay, line 2. Go ahead.
Hi. I have to say I'm somewhat concerned by your rubric of following what you call warning signs in order to stop such events, because it occurs to me, as someone who grew up going to school during the Columbine incident, that those warning signs are, pretty apt to fail by false positives and tend to degrade other rights. It seems kind of reductionistic to me to claim you can stop things by warning signs. What do you say to that?
I just disagree with you. Of course, there's always a danger of false positives, and this is one of the reasons why young people frequently don't come forward at all, because they don't really know how to interpret what they're hearing. And as you say, you know, probably 9 times out of 10, what they hear is nothing more than an offhanded comment that doesn't actually mean anything. And that is one of the difficulties of interpreting the difference between a real warning and an offhanded comment. It is exceedingly difficult, and often is clear, if clear is the word to use, only in retrospect. Nonetheless, in the cases that we studied, we could backtrack through extensive interviews with peers and came up with in the neighborhood of 12 to 15 separate incidents in which fairly clear, troubling comments were made, some so troubling that kids didn't actually come to school that Monday morning because they were afraid. In the case in Arkansas that we studied, the kids knew who'd done the shooting before the police arrived to arrest them because they had heard these warnings. So the problem is that it is very difficult to interpret. They are very clear warning signs, but a lot of other comments that might be thought of as warnings turn out not to be. And therein lies a very serious problem, which I completely concur is problematic. This is why what we need are ways of looking into these kinds of comments that are confidential, quiet, but thorough nonetheless, because it can be a sign of something terrible on the way.
Mm-hmm. It's a reassuring thing to hear. Thank you.
Yeah, I want to thank the listener for his call, and I want to ask a question before we take some more calls. How often are the shooters the victims of bullies? What's the relationship to their peers?
This is complicated as well, because what the research shows is that people who feel bullied often are no more and no less victimized by bullying than others. This is not to discount their experience. Adolescence in particular is a pretty miserable time for most people. And so there's a lot of jockeying and social hierarchy and ostracism going on for most teenagers. The kid who becomes a school shooter at a young age has faulty interpretive equipment, and they look upon these interactions in a way that exaggerates their importance. And so to them, it feels like true persecution. The same kind of conduct might feel to another person as, you know, kind of the typical thing you go through, which is also no fun. And actually, there are really epidemic levels of adolescent depression in the U.S., which are traceable to things like bullying. But for the kid who's at the beginnings of a psychiatric disorder, that will feel like a real avalanche of oppression in ways that might be more readily shrugged off by others. That said, there is a lot of evidence that people who feel bullied also turn around and bully others. It's ironic, but these two behaviors seem to go together much
mm-hmm.
of the time.
Well, it's interesting because we had the call from the listener who talked about cruelty to animals.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the same kind of a similar dynamic. That's why I raised the question.
Yes, well, there are some very serious interactional breakdowns that are occurring all the time around people who become school shooters. But it's important to recognize that it may not be worse than what other people experience, which is not to shrug it off, because what other kids experience needs to be taken more seriously than we do. But it is to say that filtered through the lens of someone who is going through the beginnings of a true mental breakdown, it feels much worse than it might feel to someone else. Now, we can't really turn to that explanation for someone who's 27 years old unless we're going to credit that a long background, perhaps, of social unhappiness and marginality finally caught up to him. I don't know. It's going to take time for us to unpack what happened in this particular instance.
David?
I think we have some other callers here we'd like to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that, and we'll go next to talk with someone in St. Louis. This is on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just tuned in a few minutes ago, so I apologize if this has already been addressed. I wonder if it's not outside the domain of your guest, if she thinks that stricter gun control laws might help reduce some of these school shootings. You know that some shooters get their guns legally, others get them illegally, and I'd listen to any comments you might have off the air.
All right, thanks. Obviously, it's a question that will be raised and is raised in these situations. And I think that we should point out that as far as we know in this particular case, that this individual got his guns legally.
And he had a firearms identification card.
Right.
Yes, that is absolutely true. Well, one thing that we can say for sure is if you couldn't get your hands on a gun, you could not commit a rampage shooting. That almost goes without saying. And I do think every time these cases come up, we ask ourselves whether there is any real legitimate purpose for civilians to gain access to automatic weapons. I mean, it's almost, I mean, from the viewpoint of people outside the United States, there is a real fundamental flaw in the way we think about the liberties of individuals to gain access to guns. That is a very politically sensitive topic, but, you know, it just is the case. If it were harder to get a hold of guns, it would be much harder to commit these horrible acts. That said, as you pointed out, people can acquire guns illegally, and so even tighter legal gun controls doesn't make it impossible. But I would say that anything that can be done to frustrate the ability of a killer of this kind to get a hold of a gun will lessen the frequency of these events. They will not drive them down to zero because illegal possession of guns is always possible. Now, that said, when we did this research, one of the things we discovered was that, yes, there are hundreds of thousands of guns on America's streets, but this is not because more people have guns. It's actually because the number of people who have guns, or the people who have guns, have more guns than they used to have. So it's hard to credit the spread of guns per se as the causal mechanism here, because the fact that people who own guns own more of them than they used to is not a particularly persuasive explanation for why these cases seem to be cropping up as they are. But that said, yes, if you couldn't get your hands on a gun, it would be harder to do this.
Yeah. What about rage, anger, rage? What about the larger culture?
Well, you know, here's one of these cases in which it's very hard to say what role rage plays versus what role the desire to be admired plays. I don't think it's an accident that the young men who do these crimes, and they are virtually always young men, are dressed in black with a particular kind of stance in mind. They're not just shooting people in a spontaneous fashion. They are adopting a character or persona, which they see frequently in an admirable fashion in the media, in film, video games. So some people have argued that these images in video games, for example, spark rage. Our research suggested otherwise, that what they spark is a desire to be similarly admired, and that's what prompts this kind of adopting of an anti-hero character when playing out these school shootings. But underneath, there's no question that most school shooters feel marginal. They feel that they're not socially acceptable. They are looking to change the way other people think about them, and they adopt that anti-hero persona because it seems more socially acceptable than the loser, which is the way they're normally thought of by themselves and by their peers. That may not have been the case for this young man, because what we know about him so far doesn't entirely fit this profile I'm drawing, but it certainly fits the ones we studied for the high school shooters.
Yeah. Just real quickly, and I want to get on some other calls here, your comments there just again raised in my mind the question of media coverage of these events and whether somehow the way that they are covered and how extensively they're covered might make the problem worse.
It is very much a double-edged sword, media coverage. If the media did not cover these events, we would not know that they really do happen, and the kind of warning behavior I was speaking about before wouldn't be interpreted in ways that cause people to come forward. And it's the coming forward that helps the police stop these events in those instances where they're able to do so. Sadly, not in this one, but in other ones. On the other hand, it is certainly true that media coverage creates the glory, creates the anti-hero image, and does lead others toward that imitative path, because what they're looking for is the kind of notoriety that can, in a sense, only be produced or manufactured through the media. So it's a very difficult issue, and I think for our colleagues in the media world, it's a very difficult ethical issue. If they didn't report these events, they would cut down on the notoriety, but they would also make it less easy for the rest of us to see these things really happen, which is what causes us to come forward and stop the events in their tracks.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to another caller. Listener on line one, you're on the air here on the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you for bringing such a knowledgeable and esteemed guest on the show. Just a further comment about the previous caller's question. I heard the NPR news report before this show stating that Barack Obama has said that he favors the right to bear arms, and I was quite disappointed to hear that. But he also added that we have to look at the violence in our culture. And I recall then Bowling for Columbine, the movie by Michael Moore, had looked at the fact that Canadians have just as many guns as Americans do, but they don't have these kinds of violent acts, and was trying to look and understand, you know, why our culture is so violent. And another part I have, a question I have, is there any relationship to, I think it was about the early 1980s it started, that mental health programs were severely cut, and the relationship of that fact to perhaps an increase in violence. And one other thing is that the Virginia Tech student had selective mutism, they discovered, and if you know about that, that he was troubled with that from childhood. And if you could make that comment, and I'll just listen. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for all of your insights. Let me begin with Bowling for Columbine and the question of the Canadian contrast. It's actually not so sharp a contrast anymore, because there have been some horrific incidents very much like Columbine in Canada in the last couple of years. And I've spent a fair amount of time on Canadian public broadcasting trying to account for them, because one of the things that's sort of unusual and strange about the Canadian cases is that, unlike the American ones, the Canadian cases were taking place in some of their largest cities. In the U.S. in general, these rampage shootings have not taken place in our major urban areas. They've taken place mostly in small, isolated towns. And their isolation is part of what produces the pattern of a rampage shooting, because the marginality that the shooter feels is so hard to erase through contact with people who are different from himself, because he's, you know, in a place like outside of Jonesboro, Arkansas, which is 5 hours from the nearest big city, or Paducah, Kentucky, again, hours and hours away from a metropolitan area. And if you are in a very isolated place, if you're doing well socially, you're fine. You feel very comfortable and happy, and you know everyone around you, and it's a wonderful environment. But if you're socially marginal, it feels like a permanent life sentence to being excluded and to feeling unloved by others. The Canadian cases, by sharp contrast, were occurring in Montreal, in their biggest cities. And so that was one of the puzzles to try and understand in the Canadian cases. So it's sadly not really the case that they don't happen in Canada. I think gun violence in general is lower in Canada, but this particular kind of incident is different from garden variety background violence. In the United States, for example, we certainly have the biggest problems with general violence, even general gun mayhem, in our biggest cities. But these kind of rampage shootings don't happen in big cities. So it is a different kind of phenomenon. We need to understand these patterns a little bit better. In terms of the right to bear arms, I mean, this is a matter of great political controversy. I didn't hear Senator Obama's comments on this subject, but I will say that ask any police chief, and they will tell you that there is no rationale for civilians to have access to automatic weapons. There isn't a police chief in the country who believes that that is sound public policy. And, in fact, they are often among the most stringent advocates of gun control, in part because they're the ones who often receive the consequences of unrestrained access to guns. So I really wish we had a more rational policy around this issue. But I have to say, you know, in deference to those who wouldn't agree with me, that someone who is really dedicated to getting their hands on a gun will find a way. That doesn't mean that gun control is a bad idea, because any way you can frustrate people and make it harder will eliminate some cases that aren't willing to go that far. But in the case we studied, for example, in Arkansas, you know, these two kids took a blowtorch to a safe to try and get guns out. If someone is willing to go that far, it's really very hard to erect a public policy that will completely stop them from doing so.
This afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine, we're spending some time talking about the shootings that took place yesterday at Northern Illinois University and trying to get a better understanding of why these kinds of things happen. And we're talking here with Catherine Newman. She's a professor of sociology at Princeton University, one of the authors of the 2004 book Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. At this point in the conversation, we'd like to bring in an additional guest. We're joined by Jan Carter-Black. She is Assistant Professor of Social Work here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and she was an advisor to Stephen Kazmierczak, the gunman in yesterday's shootings. Professor Black, thanks very much for talking with us. I'm sorry that it has to be under these kind of circumstances.
It's a very difficult situation. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you.
We have heard from you earlier today in our news coverage that the student was a good and thoughtful student. I wonder, what were his goals following his studies, and did he have friends? What can you tell us about that?
Well, I'm not certain what his ultimate career goals were. Mm-hmm. I know that he was interested in work in prison systems, but in what capacity, we had no occasion to discuss those kinds of career choices in any greater detail than that. And as far as his social life and whether or not he had friends, again, my relationship with Stephen was as his advisor and then as his instructor. And so there would have been no occasion for us to discuss who his intimate or personal friends were or anything of that nature
Did you have any sense of outside interests, his interests outside the field of sociology?
No, I was not at all aware of his interest outside of social work, which was where my relationship with Stephen began when he entered our MSW program, our Master's of Social Work program here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. So I don't know about any other outside activities or events of interest that he might have been engaged in.
Catherine Newman, do you have a question for Jan Carter-Black?
Well, no, I think I just want to express my sympathy because I have spent a lot of time talking to people who were in similar roles with school shooters, counselors, teachers. And they often feel, I'm hopefully Professor Black doesn't, but they often feel that somehow they should have been able to see things which wouldn't have been evident to anyone in this kind of role. You know, my heart goes out to the teachers in a similar position at Virginia Tech who were very alarmed by the behavior of that shooter who was giving off many more signals than Stephen was, and made every effort to intervene, and it wasn't successful, but not for lack of trying. The truth of the matter is that people who are, as Professor Black is, or as I am on my campus, in a particular kind of role with a student, do not have access to their entire lives. It's not really, we don't consider it our business to get to know about their intimate lives. But that means that we sometimes feel like we should have been able to see, and it's just not realistic. None of us could.
Well, this is David Inge. I just wondered if I could ask Professor Black, in the reporting that we have all now been reading about what happened, there were quotes saying that Stephen had recently begun to behave in a quote-unquote erratic manner. I have no idea what that means. Had you seen any behavior from him recently that would lead you to believe that anything was going on, that he was having any personal problems that would lead you to be concerned?
No, as a matter of fact, there were no indicators, no behavioral indicators or anything else that I saw from Stephen in the entire time that I knew him, which would have begun again in the late summer of 2007. There was nothing that I saw from him that would have raised any sort of red flags or concerns on my part. He was a very personable young man. He was very engaging. He was very motivated, a good student. So my last even informal interaction with him would have been somewhere in the early part of January, mid-January to late January. And it was simply passing him in the hallway. Mm-hmm. And Stephen spoke to me, and I spoke to him the way we always did, in a very friendly and easygoing manner, just to say hello, how are you, good to see you, and we went on our way. No, there was nothing that I would have detected at any point in the relationship mm-hmm. that I had with him that would have suggested something of this magnitude.
Professor Black, again, our thanks for your joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Jan Carter Black is an assistant professor of social work at the University of Illinois here in Urbana. We have to wrap up here now with Catherine Newman, and I guess we had an email question, and maybe you could talk with us about this issue for a minute. And I'm sorry that it's another great big topic. A listener raises the question: are shootings on college campuses more like workplace shootings than they are school ground shootings?
I think that rampage shootings, both at high schools and on college campuses, are more like workplace shootings than they are like other kinds of background violence. There are some differences. Very often school shootings are carried out by one person, but with the knowledge of others, and sometimes they are carried out even by teams. That is, they're not completely individuals, which is what you typically see in a workplace shooting. But where I think the similarity lies is in the desire of the shooter to attack the institution, not specifically targeting individuals, but to attack the institution that they're part of. And, yes, I think that's a very astute observation, and it's something that I argue in the book, that we shouldn't think, despite the similarity, we shouldn't think of school shootings as somehow the tip of an iceberg that's about school violence. We should think of it as part of this family of events that's more like workplace shootings that are attacks on institutions.
Okay, there we have to leave it. Professor Newman, thank you very much for joining us this
My
afternoon.
Pleasure.
Catherine Newman is a professor of sociology at Princeton University. She's one of the authors of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and here we wrap it up. And our thanks this afternoon to our producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. They did a wonderful job pulling things together for us today. And also, I want to thank David Inge this afternoon for helping me in the studio this afternoon, balancing all the elements that we had to work with here this afternoon. Thank you very
thank
much,
you.
David.